This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts drivers, listen up, because this one impacts all of us. Now, when Governor Baker announced last month that he isn't running for re-election this year, it put a 12-month, basically ticking clock on his remaining priorities. And one of those, a bill to address marijuana-impaired driving. Baker has reintroduced legislation that failed in 2019 as critics raised concern about protecting civil liberties. Now, Governor Baker named the bill after State Trooper Tom Clardy, who was killed in his cruiser in 2016. The driver of the other car had purchased medical marijuana shortly before the accident, had traces in his system after, though, as we will discuss, THC can remain in your system for days or even weeks after use, long after any impairment has subsided. And as a result, the judge in that case found that the other driver was guilty of involuntary manslaughter, but the judge argued that the prosecutors had failed to prove he was impaired. Unlike alcohol, there is not a clear standard way to measure marijuana impairment. So here we are, clearly a priority for Governor Baker. We want to ask, should it be, and what actually would it mean for Massachusetts drivers? Let's hash that out. We're going to invite you to join the conversation. What do you think? Do we need more laws to hold drivers accountable for driving under the influence of marijuana? Or are you concerned that innocent drivers could potentially face punishment under the proposed legislation? Have you had the experience of being pulled over before and being accused of impaired driving from marijuana use? Do you think this bill could be enforced fairly? Add your thoughts, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So we have three guests to help us have this conversation. First, Dr. Kevin Hill, director of the Division of Addiction Psychiatry at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and author of Marijuana, the Unbiased Truth About the World's Most Popular Weed. Dr. Hill, welcome.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Now, also John Carmichael, Chief of Police in Newton, Massachusetts, who was a member of the state's Special Commission on Operating Under the Influence and Impaired Driving. And that commission created the recommendations the governor's Baker's bill is based on. Chief Carmichael, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And lastly, John Amabile, President of the Massachusetts Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. John, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. I'm very happy to have been invited to participate in what I think is a very important issue.
And I am looking forward to diving in. We have a lot to cover. Dr. Hill, I'm going to start with a couple of questions to you. And we're going to start with the basics. When someone smokes marijuana, what is the possible impairment? You know, I'm thinking of that old ad, what does your brain look like on weed?
As it relates to driving, I think it's important to draw comparison between cannabis and alcohol. So both of them clearly affect your ability to drive, but they do it in different ways. So the body processes marijuana differently than it processes alcohol. And so there are a number of behaviors and abilities that are involved in driving, and cannabis affects many of them, including the ability to estimate time and distance, affects your memory, reaction time, the ability to stop and use your brakes, the ability to process information, concentration, and also the ability to process multiple information points at once. So clearly, driving after you consume cannabis is a risky activity.
As I understand it, there is a pretty wide variety in terms of level of impairment depending on the person with the same, let's say, amount of ingestion, for example, Dr. Hill. Is that correct?
Absolutely true. So just as is true with alcohol, the body type and somebody's weight, what they've had to eat in the time prior to using alcohol or cannabis, and certainly their experience with the substance all matter when trying to determine if somebody's impaired.
All right. So last question to you before we widen it out. And I feel like this is a big question for our listeners to understand the answer to, Dr. Hill. Why is it so hard to measure? Now, I understand that actually in the legal field right now, even alcohol breathalyzers are being questioned. They're temporarily suspended in courts in Massachusetts for OUI cases. But measuring impairment from marijuana, even harder. Explain why that is.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, the body processes these substances differently. And so therefore, the science of driving and blood alcohol content is crystal clear. And so there's corresponding blood levels with impairment. And unfortunately, there are no such corresponding clear-cut limits to blood THC levels and impairment. And so the presence of THC, the metabolite, in cannabis does not equate to intoxication. And as a result of that, many states have taken to combining biochemical verification of use, either a yes or no test or a level, with various roadside assessments to provide law enforcement, who has a very difficult job, multiple data points to make their assessment.
All right. So just to simplify that for listeners, basically you're saying it's hard to – how much is in the system may not correlate fully to impairment. Right now the practice and the recommended practice in the legislation is visual, you seem impaired, plus biometric measures that would happen as well. Is that basically correct?
Yeah, I think the law or the bill that Governor Baker put forth is really trying to treat marijuana like alcohol. And so what law enforcement and the chief can speak to this, I mean, when someone is pulled over for driving under the influence of alcohol, again, you're using multiple data points. You're doing field sobriety testing along with a breathalyzer in that case. And I think the idea of this law is to try to put a similar framework in place so that people can be held accountable for choosing to use cannabis and then drive.
Okay, so here's how we're going to do this. I'm going to go to Chief Carmichael next, and then I'll go to Attorney Amabile. Attorney Amabile, I know you'll probably have some things to say about what Dr. Hill just said, but let me go to Chief Carmichael first. I want to bring you in here. Is this a problem you are seeing in Newton? And currently, how would one of your officers deal with a driver suspected of being under the influence of marijuana?
Sure. Thank you. Well, first of all, I just want to clarify one thing quick. This is not solely focused on just marijuana impairment, but drug impairment in general. So as we know, we already have many safeguards and procedures in place on how we address people who are driving impaired under the influence of alcohol. That's never really extended as much to how we deal with drugs and people who are under the influence of, you know, marijuana or poly drug use, where you have multiple drugs involved, or drugs and alcohol mixed. So we're at a different kind of way of handling this. But, you know, going back to the Trooper Clardy case, this is a perfect example of what we're dealing with. There's two different types of dynamics. One could be that a police officer pulls a motorist over for some type of violations, you know, where there could be some driving behavior that could have been going through a stop sign. It could have been speeding. It could have been marked lanes violations, a variety of different things. Or there's other situations where a crash occurred and somebody is transported to the hospital and we have to do the investigation from there. But if you look at the Trooper Clardy case, an individual had left, had been consuming marijuana, had been driving, and with the judge's determination, the way that we should be looking at it is the best indicator of impairment should be the operation and how the vehicle was being operated at the time. And that being having a lot of weight to it, because that's what we're always looking for. That's usually what starts to stop off in the beginning.
So, Chief Carmichael, excuse me for interrupting you, but I do want to clarify. As I understand it, and you may understand it better, but as I understand it, in the Clardy case, we know that the other driver had purchased marijuana prior to the accident. We know there was THC in the other driver's system, but I'm not sure it's clear that he was actually ingesting or had ingested marijuana. If you know differently, please forgive me and go ahead and clarify.
Right. No, the way you said it, I believe, is how it was. But the issue is that if it's in someone's system, I'm sure we'll probably get into that. When you travel across four lanes of a highway and rear end a cruiser, and you know you cause a crash like that with a fatality, you can't ignore the fact that the operation of the vehicle is a very significant indicator.
So was one of your officers right now, let's say, confronted with a situation where they see an erratic driver, they have concern, how would they engage with this question with a driver right now?
Sure. So things have changed in Massachusetts. We now have, we used to be doing standardized field sobriety testing, as you would for alcohol. And we've learned from the Commonwealth versus Gerhardt case that was not adequate. So what happened was, based on that case law, we now do what's called roadside assessments. When we do roadside assessments, when we believe or suspect somebody is impaired by drugs. We do the same types of testing. We call it roadside assessments, but the officers cannot testify in court that somebody failed or passed those assessments.
And this is like walk in a straight line, touch your nose, those kinds of things?
Correct. Yes, we do the same assessments, but you cannot testify as to the conclusion that the person failed those tests and as such they are impaired. So we can only testify to the observations that are made, and that there could have been some diminished capacity on a variety of those assessments. They can testify to that. They can testify to the behavior, the attitude, the demeanor, or you can testify to any evidence, you know, or visual indicators such as, you know, the glassy bloodshot eyes or the presence of any type of drugs and that type of thing. So that those are the initial part usually of the dynamics of the motor vehicle stop that may, you know, start the process of an arrest.
Okay.
And what we try and do is we know that it's difficult with OUI drugs here in Massachusetts. For law enforcement, it's very important that motorists who you suspect have a diminished capacity to drive because of any substance needs to be removed from the road. So we're always going to be obligated to do that, keep our roads safe. The problem we're running into is with the courts, with evidence, even providing exculpatory evidence, which we can get into if you want.
Okay, thank you for that. So now I'm going to turn to Attorney John Amabile, President of the Massachusetts Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. I imagine there's some things that you want to weigh in here. Present the challenges here, Attorney Amabile.
Well, all right. I think we should start off with this proposition. Driving under the influence of drugs is illegal now, and it has been for years under the same statute that prescribes driving under the influence of alcohol. And the people who are pushing this legislation are the same people who oppose the ballot initiative. And they brought this
up. To legalize marijuana in the Commonwealth.
Exactly. In other words, the police, Governor Baker, these people all were on this high horse before the ballot initiative was passed. And the fact of the matter is that it sort of presented like after marijuana was legalized, there's an explosion in marijuana use and driving under the influence of marijuana. That is a complete falsehood. There is no evidence, A, that more people smoke pot now than before when it was illegal, and B, whether or not there's any increase in driving under the influence of pot.
So I'm just going to have you pause there to just give a little data, and then you can pick it back up. This is Boston Globe reporting from last November. Massachusetts State Police statistics don't reflect any dramatic change since pot stores opened. Of the 8,498 arrests and criminal summonses issued by troopers for operating under the influence, this is from January 19 through mid-August 2021, 83% were for alleged, alcohol impaired driving. Most of the remaining 1,036 citations for alleged drug impaired driving involved opioids, state police officials said. So there's the data. Go ahead.
Well, okay. That's exactly right. So this is a solution in search of a problem that doesn't exist. Now, it is also absolutely correct that the police have the power to make arrests for this and to prosecute these cases in court. However, they are held to the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the bedrock of our criminal justice system. What this statute purports to do is to completely trample on that fundamental right. One of the main premises is that it would allow a judge to take quote-unquote judicial notice that THC can and does impair you. That's tantamount to saying if the police bring somebody in on one of these charges who has a THC in his blood system, which means absolutely nothing in terms of impairment, the judge can simply find the person guilty without applying all of the legal standards.
Okay,
that is an outrageous, horrible idea.
I'm going to pause you there. Some strong language there, and that's why we brought you here. We knew this would be your position. We're trying to present all the sides. I know Chief Carmichael wants to jump back in here. Chief Carmichael, go ahead.
Sure. Well, a lot of that was incorrect. If you go back to look at Chapter 55, the Act 2017, that was the adult use marijuana law. When that passed, that created the Special Commission on Operating Under the Influence and Impaired Driving.
There
was
you served on that commission.
Yeah, there's 13 members on that commission.
I would ask Officer Carmichael is, was he active in the anti-ballot initiative campaign?
Well, you're free to answer that, Chief Carmichael.
That's irrelevant, number one. Number two, I'm actually still a standing member of the Cannabis Advisory Board. I've done more for the marijuana industry and bringing that and doing that right here in Massachusetts than probably anybody. But
Attorney Amabile, and then I'll come back to you.
The commission was made up of defense attorneys, judge, the ACLU, law enforcement, AAA, a variety of people, scientists, people in the medical field that were all part of this commission, many different disciplines and a very diverse group of people. And ultimately, that group came up with 19 recommendations that were submitted to the legislature, all of which were agreed upon. And if you actually look at the 498 pages that was created as a result of the commission that went into creating the legislation to fix our OUI laws, a lot went into that.
So I'm going to pause there. I have read the executive summary portion of that. I do want to note the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union rep, on the committee was against these recommendations.
He was against some of it, but he wasn't against all of it.
Fair enough. So let's go back to Attorney Amabile now.
Well, there are some non-controversial provisions like giving police officers more training. No one can argue with that. And a variety of other things that are non-controversial. But when you start having, for example, legislation that mandates that a court accept police testimony as drug recognition experts, that is a fundamentally flawed provision of the law. Exactly. Expert testimony, there's a series of important safeguards to make sure that it's reliable testimony. So those have to be followed in court. Now there.
So I'm going to stop you there again. I'm sorry. I'm going to aggressively manage traffic flow here for a number of reasons. I may or may not get to the callers who are waiting. Callers, I know you are waiting, but we have a lot to cover here. And I want to come back to Dr. Hill for two reasons. So my first question is, Dr. Hill, is there anything you want to react to in the things you've already heard?
Yeah, I'd say, first of all, I mean, I'm somebody who, in principle, is in favor of legalization of cannabis. So I think adults should be able to do what they want as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. And my fear here in looking at the data, and so one piece of data that hasn't been mentioned is that the proportion of cannabis positive drivers involved in fatal motor vehicle accidents has increased in the medical cannabis states and not in the non-medical cannabis states. And as somebody who tries to be objective about this, that concerns me. And as you mentioned earlier, the data from the Globe and how there weren't that many cases involving cannabis, that makes me fear that law enforcement really doesn't have the tools to do this properly. So that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in providing a framework so that they can effectively hold people accountable who are running afoul of the law and operating under the influence of cannabis. So that's what I'm hoping to do here, I think, in looking at this evidence.
All right. So the other question that I want to ask for you, Dr. Hill, to make it super clear. Currently, there is not, as I understand it, a medical way that you can sort of test and get a yes or no, like you might on a COVID antigen test at home, right, that says you are impaired right now to X amount because of ingestion of marijuana.
No, you cannot do that.
And why is that so hard again?
Because the body processes cannabis differently than alcohol, so there's no breathalyzer equivalent. People are working on that, certainly. So again, I get back to the idea that you're trying to do the best that you can with the available tools. And for me, and looking at this, to be able to have roadside assessments plus the ability to test for cannabis, I think that does a pretty good job along those lines where, again, if you are doing something that falls along the lines of probable cause and brings a law enforcement official into the situation to evaluate your ability to drive, you know, if you crash, if you are driving recklessly, then, you know, this, I think, provides a reasonable framework. And so I would worry that as it currently stands, I mean, it's hard enough now to hold people accountable for drinking and driving. And I worry that with this law in place, with legalization in the Commonwealth, that we really don't have that currently. And I think the bill moves toward that.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do first. Just to underscore one of the points you made, according to a journal article in Addiction, the journal Addiction, looking at Colorado, Oregon, and Washington State, all of which have legalized marijuana, in total, quote, there were about 170 extra deaths in the first 6 months after a legalization. That was looking at traffic accidents. That was a point that you made, Dr. Hill. Now, Attorney Amabile, I'm going to come back to you in just a minute. I do want to go to the phones and grab a couple of calls. We've got Sam on the line in Ashland. Sam, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I was actually pulled over for speeding in Massachusetts and had the smell of marijuana in my car. And so the officer that pulled me over asked me to do a roadside sobriety test, you know, just your standard walk, you know, look at me, walk this line, et cetera. I was not impaired. I passed the test fine. The guy just let me off with a warning, let me go about my day. So I'm not really like, you know, I'm wondering what we're trying to achieve, I guess, with additional legislation here.
So that's to the do we need this question, Sam, basically.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. And listen, I do want to note that the other piece of that study that I quoted a minute ago went on to say that most of that evened out after about a year, just so that everybody knows. I want to present the full data. Let's pick up one more call. Debbie in Chelmsford. Debbie, go ahead.
Hi, yes. So I'm just, like, they went through all the, you have to do the sobriety test, all that kind of thing. But since there doesn't seem to be any actual way to show that somebody is actually impaired due to marijuana, I guess I'm confused on the part about now you're arrested. I mean, I get the part if you're driving crazy and all that stuff, but I'm confused on the part of saying that we believe because of this, this, and this, like, you know, glazed over eyes or whatever. I get glazed over eyes from allergies. I don't do marijuana. I'm just curious as to how exactly that comes about. It's just confusing. Most of it was answered, but I'm just confused about that specifically.
All right, so I'd like to get a point counterpoint on that. What I'm going to do is give Chief Carmichael a chance to answer Debbie's question and then Attorney Amabile a chance to answer the same question. And I'm going to ask the two of you, if you can, to keep those answers succinct because there's more I'd like to dig into. So, Chief Carmichael.
Sure. So every circumstance is different. Every stop is different. If it does amount to the level of probable cause, every arrest is different and what happens after that. So it's very difficult, but typically if we're just talking marijuana here, you know, there's usually going to be some type of a violation, motor vehicle violation, where the stop has occurred. Like the first caller said, the officer will make certain observations based on their training and experience. That could be a variety of different things. Then there could be an exit order where the officer asks the person to step out and offer the opportunity to take roadside assessments. Those are the same. We do those the same way that we do for alcohol, except, as I mentioned earlier, it's handled differently as far as what we can testify to later on in court. We now, once probable cause is established to believe that that person could be impaired or they have a diminished capacity to drive, and they are taken into custody, they're brought back to the police station, and they could be offered a drug recognition expert type of evaluation. Or you may have A-RIDE officers, which can also do a higher level of standard of field sobriety testing. The drug recognition experts is part of this bill where our DREs here in Massachusetts can testify in court as an expert. However, the judge has to has to declare them as an expert prior to that testimony taking place.
Okay.
So, and important thing, one more very important thing is that it includes the issue of oral fluid, which weighs into all of the other factors observed, oral fluid being used as a confirmatory analysis.
And that's oral fluid? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Like saliva?
Yeah.
Okay. Excuse me for interrupting there. Just wanted to make sure I understood. Okay. So there's – Debbie had the question. We went for point, counterpoint. There's the point from Chief Carmichael, Attorney Amabile, counterpoint.
Well, first of all, what the caller brought up is the whole issue of pretextual stops and unfair and selective enforcement of the law.
You mean people using judgment that could be biased in choosing who to stop in the first place.
Exactly. And it's Pollyanna to think that doesn't happen every day of the week. And secondly, what she also pointed out, well, I have glassy eyes. Well, that's why we have trials, and we do not have a system where the police get to decide whether you're guilty or not guilty and have you punished based on their conclusion. You have a right to a trial. So, and at that trial, the rules of evidence apply. So if somebody wants to get up there and say they're a drug recognition expert,
That is a real thing.
Excuse me?
A drug recognition expert is a real thing. I'm sorry. It sounded like you were saying somebody could just call themselves that, but that's an actual thing, correct?
They're going to have to establish in front of the judge that they are the real thing before they're going to be permitted to go in front of a jury and draw conclusions against a accused person who suffers dire consequences if found guilty. Now, we know in this country that we have a history of using phony science, which is very persuasive with jurors, to obtain wrongful convictions. And examples of that are legion.
So I'm running out of time, so I'm sorry. Just if I can get you to wrap up that point.
What I would say to you is this is a solution in search of a problem that doesn't exist. And that these provisions in this law are fundamentally impact on a person's ability to obtain fair justice in court. Okay. And therefore, this law should be resoundingly defeated.
All right. So I'm gonna stop us there. I mean, there's 7 hours of this we could do. And what I'm hoping that we will do as this continues to go through the legislature, we'll continue to follow it. For now, I really want to thank each of you for your participation. Dr. Kevin Hill is the director of the Division of Addiction Psychiatry at Beth Israel Deaconess. John Carmichael is chief of police in Newton, Massachusetts. And John Amabile is president of the Massachusetts Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys. Thank you very much to all three of you. I appreciate the time and the explanation today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
People of color have worse health outcomes than white people in America. We have known that, but the pandemic has underscored the fact painfully. So healthcare systems have become increasingly focused on solving that problem, including by increasing the diversity of healthcare providers. Research shows that a correlation exists between having providers who look like you, who understand your lived experience, and having better health outcomes. Now, that being said, according to 2018 data from the Association of Medical Colleges, only 5% of physicians, for example, are Black, 5.8% are Hispanic, roughly 56% are white, but in the overall population, 14% of the population is Black, 18% Hispanic, according to 2019 and 2020 data. Brigham and Women's is trying something new. They are trying a mentoring program designed to attract people of color into becoming physician's assistants, a key healthcare provider, and then helping them get through that program successfully. We have a few guests here to help us talk about that program. Aileen Snetka is a senior physician assistant at Brigham and Women's, founded the program. Kimberly Rivera, also a physician's assistant there, is a mentor in the program, and she is mentoring Gabriesus, who's studying to become a physician's assistant at Massachusetts General Hospital. So Aileen, Kimberly, Horena, welcome to all three of you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Great to have you. So, Aileen and Kimberly, I'm going to turn to you for just a second. It is a hard time to be a healthcare worker. Aileen, how are you doing?
You know, it's definitely been a challenging time with the COVID-19 pandemic. I think I'm doing okay in the grand scheme of things and leaning on my colleagues for support.
And Kimberly, how about you?
Yeah, a similar situation as Aileen. I basically started my career during the pandemic, so I don't know anything besides this. But, you know, through the help of my colleagues, and Aileen's actually my mentor, we've been getting through it together.
Wow. Wow. To start during the pandemic, I imagine it is kind of hard to imagine what normal would be. And I think that's going to come up. I'm going to come back to Aileen for just a minute longer here. With so much on your plate, especially during a pandemic, you took time to found this program. So why? Why is it so important, do you believe, to have diverse physicians' assistants?
Yeah, so as someone who identifies as a Latina, I think I've always been very aware of the fact that there's a lack of diversity in medicine, specifically in clinicians. And so during the pandemic, as you were saying, it became more apparent that our minority patients really needed to be supported, especially with different social resources and in their complex medical care. And so I reached out to the Brigham and Women's Emergency Department Office of Ideas and applied for a SPARK grant with the goal of creating this mentorship program between the emergency services assistants and the physician assistants in the department so that we could hopefully support our colleagues who want to pursue advanced degrees to complete this mentorship program to then go on to become medical professionals and increase the diversity in the workforce to then come back and take care of patients who look like them and have shared experiences and really can relate to them on both like a personal and cultural level.
So Kimberly, at first, just to clarify, a physician's assistant does about 80% of everything that an MD does, is supervised by an MD, and goes through extensive training, about 7 years of education to become a PA. Is that correct?
Yep. So exactly. It's 4 years of undergrad, and then you do either 2 to 3 years in a physician assistant program and then can start practicing.
And you recently came into this field, again, during a pandemic when people are being crushed in the healthcare field by the work, but decided to be a mentor nonetheless. Why?
You know, I also identify as a Latina, and I'm a first-generation college student, so no one in my family before me went to college, and no one was involved in medicine. I kind of fumbled my way through it and struggled at times, and you know, it was very difficult. And so when I joined Brigham, they actually pair you with a mentor, and Aileen is my mentor and helped me through, you know, onboarding and my experiences there. So it was even before starting Brigham, I always wanted to, if I could help someone in any sort of way get to their career goals, that was something I was always interested in. And so when this opportunity came up, even with the limited experience I had, you know, it was intimidating, but it was more important to me to help someone get through something that I wish I would have had.
So, Horaina, let me turn to you and thank you for being patient while I asked Aileen and Kimberly some questions there. What brought you into the program and into wanting to be a physician's assistant?
I was always interested in working with patients. I was unclear on what exactly I wanted to do, but I knew that I always wanted to work with patients. And so what brought me into the physician assistant role was actually my conversations with the physicians and the physician assistants at Brigham and Women's and getting their life experiences and understanding why it is that they chose the field they did. That helped me in clarifying that this is what I wanted to do. And something that the physician assistant role offers is the ability to switch from one profession to the other. And so I'm currently interested in emergency medicine, but if that ends up not being the case, I can switch into a different profession and just be able to dip my toes in a lot of different things is what I'm interested in.
And by profession, do you mean a different specialty? So, excuse me, if not emergency room, then maybe a surgery unit or intensive care. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
So, Kimberly, what would have been, well, I won't ask you what would have been different for you because Aileen is mentoring you. What has Aileen done for you that you want to do for Horaina?
She's helped me both professionally and personally. From a professional aspect, we share similar interests in that we're both, we are very interested in diversity and inclusivity. And so from that aspect, she, you know, she helps me grow outside of a clinical aspect. In the beginning, she met with me routinely and sort of reviewed common emergency medicine cases and how to best approach it as a new PA. That was very helpful. So from a clinical and professional aspect, she's been that for me. And then personally, when I've had, you know, in the beginning, it's, I think a lot of us are nervous starting and insecure. And I would reach out to her with my experiences because sometimes it can feel like you're the only one that's struggling. And she shared stories with me. So it made me feel better about the things I was going through. So it's just nice to know. And even now, 2 years later, you know, we don't talk every day, but I have her phone number, her email. And recently I've reached out to her when I had a tough case and she's helped me walk through it. But both from, again, a clinical standpoint and personally being like, no, that, you know, this is what could have done better. And it's just, it's nice to have her as that resource.
Aileen, I know I may be putting you on the spot a little bit with this, but do you happen to remember one of the stories that you've shared with Kimberly that may have made a difference to Kimberly?
Sure. I think always as a new clinician, it's important to share some difficult cases you've had. So I won't share all the details of the case, but I had one particular case where I had a female patient who was very ill and decompensated in the emergency department. And I remember it was during the beginning of my career and I felt very helpless and wanted to make sure that I was doing everything in my power to save this patient who was from a different country, didn't speak English, and was, again, very, very sick in the emergency department. And so I remember sharing that with Kim and explaining to her that there are going to be these scenarios where you're uncomfortable and you might not know exactly what to do, but to always remember that in the emergency department, we're a collaborative team. We all work together, and to feel free to reach out to anyone in the department to help you. And so I think that kind of set the scene for her difficult case. And I'm hoping that she was able to reach out to someone during her shift for help during that case.
Were you, Kimberly?
Yeah, I definitely felt supported, but you know, in the heat of the moment, sometimes you don't have time to process. So it's afterward where I kind of looked for someone. I'm like, can we debrief about this now that I have the time to think through it?
So, Herena, one of the points of a mentoring program is to help people stay in the game during the long and deeply challenging process of getting certified for something like this. Are you intimidated by that process? And how do you think you'll lean on Kimberly to help you stay in the game?
I definitely leaned on Kimberly when I was starting out, and she told me that, of course, it's going to be difficult, but it's just going to be another challenge and you're going to get through it. And so just getting that kind of information or reassurance from someone who has gone through the process and has had a similar background as I have reassured me that it's going to be okay. It's going to be hard. There are going to be days where going to fall apart, but that's okay because I'm going to get right back up. And I'm going to finish it. So that was really amazing to hear from someone who went through it.
Herena, go ahead.
And even now there are days where it's difficult. And so, if I'm not able to handle it, I'll gladly reach out to her because I have all of her contact. Just be like, this is what's happening. Do you have any advice?
That was the other part of my question. Thank you. So, Kimberly, I'll turn back to you. Have you in your life or in your family's life ever had an experience where if the healthcare provider you'd encountered understood your lived experience better, looked more like you, was more culturally competent for you, you might have had a better outcome or felt more comfortable?
So I can talk about a patient case, actually. Is I had someone yesterday, I was at work. He walked by me in the hallway and he stopped me. He's like, thank you so much. I had taken care of him several months ago. And he's like, thank you so much for taking care of me. He was a Spanish-speaking only patient. He's like, you've helped me so much. I'm doing so much better. And the interesting story behind this is that I had taken over his care from a prior clinician that was non-Spanish-speaking. And I was sort of just following through with what the plan they had laid out. The only difference was when I took over, I went into the room to introduce myself and they were like, oh my God, they saw me like, do you speak Spanish? I'm like, yes. And they had a lot of questions. We reviewed the plan. The results had come and the plan moving forward. And then, you know, the patient went home and things, you know, I thought that was the end of it. And I just happened to see him randomly yesterday. And it's funny that he attributes to his excellent care to me when I was just following through with a prior clinician's plan. And so that just highlights that, you know, we all go through these rigorous trainings and we're taught how to take care of patients. And there's sort of an outline on how to do it, but no one can teach connections. And so being able to speak to this patient in his native language made all the difference, even though the treatment plan laid out was by someone prior to me.
That's a great story. Thank you for sharing it. So, Aileen, I'm on a firm clock here, so I'm going to say in a sentence or two, if your program is successful, what does that look like?
I think for this program to continue to be successful, we would have PAs and ESAs working together, continuing with the mentorship program, to then have the ESAs who complete the program go on to advanced degree programs such as nursing, PA school, medical school, and then eventually come back and practice at Brigham and Women's Hospital. So it would increase retention. And really, if any of these PAs come back and practice at the Brigham and are able to make those connections with patients, advocate for their patients, build rapport and trust in their same language, I think patient outcomes will improve, employee satisfaction will improve, and overall we'll be giving excellent care.
Well, that is Aileen Snetka, Senior Physician Assistant at Brigham's and Women's, Kimberly Rivera, also a Physician's Assistant there and a mentor, and Harena Gabriel-Seuss, who's studying to become a Physician's Assistant at Mass General Hospital. Thanks to the three of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
When someone is diagnosed with schizophrenia, a psychotic disorder marked by delusional thinking, they often experience fear and anxiety. A group of Massachusetts-based researchers and advocates say that changing the name of the mental illness could go a long way to reducing its stigma. But others say the term itself is not the problem. Karen Brown reports.
Linda Larson hurries through her apartment building in Cambridge and doesn't answer interview questions until she gets through the lobby to the parking lot.
People probably think of me as eccentric, which is fine, but I don't want to go over the details of what it meant to be diagnosed with schizophrenia in front of.
She nods towards a building manager and a few other residents milling about at the mailboxes. She'd rather they not know she has the mental illness. As it happens, this interview is about the stigma of schizophrenia and what people think when they hear the term.
It's kind of like sociopath, but it's worse. There's no expectation except violence and disengagement.
That's why Larson, who is 74, is among those advocating for a new name for schizophrenia. In fact, she came up with one while sitting with friends at a cafe. She was trying to explain what it was like to live with a psychotic illness for decades.
I said it's like an altered perception. Your perception doesn't read the way other people do. It's altered by the illness.
So altered perception disorder became one of 9 alternative names suggested by a group Larson is involved with, the Consumer Advisory Board. It's part of the Massachusetts Mental Health Center, based at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Together with researchers, they put out a survey recently to get a sense of how many other stakeholders would like to change the name.
That term, over time, has become so associated with hopelessness, dangerousness, with volatile and erratic behavior that doctors are afraid to use that term.
Raquel Meshulam-Gately is a Harvard psychologist who helped lead the survey, which was published in the journal Schizophrenia Research. Meshulam-Gately says people often confuse schizophrenia with dissociative identity disorder, which used to be called multiple personalities. And she says it's not just a semantic problem.
I really think it interferes with people even wanting to get care to begin with, because there's so much stigma surrounding the term.
Schizophrenia was given its name more than 100 years ago when Dr. Eugene Bleuler described the disorder as a splitting of psychological functions. So he used the Greek words for split mind or schizophrenia.
Schizophrenia in particular is so misused. People just randomly and casually throwing out the term, oh, he's so schizophrenic, that's so schizophrenic, that you don't hear that as much with other kinds of conditions.
Out of about 1,200 people in the recent survey, 3/4 said they want a new name for schizophrenia. In addition to altered perception disorder, other suggestions included attunement disorder, integration disorder, and disconnectivity syndrome. To Linda Larson, any of those would be better than schizophrenia. She first started having delusions in the 1960s when she was a teenager.
For a while, I thought silver cars were CIA, green cars were Army, blue cars were Air Force, black cars were Secret Service.
She managed to start a PhD program in literature at the University of Mississippi when she had a major psychotic break.
I stood outside a gas station and decided that I should blow it up. And I had a big lighter in my hand, and for some reason I didn't.
At that point, a doctor diagnosed her with schizophrenia and suggested she abandon her education.
Told me and my parents that I would never be able to work as anything but a waitress. And that was a joke, because if there's one thing you can't do when you tend to psychosis, is be a waitress.
She spent the next 20 years in and out of psychiatric hospitals. But in the early 90s, she started taking a drug called clozapine. That drug can have serious side effects and doesn't work for everyone. But Larson says she hasn't had a psychotic episode since. She's published books of poetry and had a long marriage until her husband died. Larson believes it's time to call the illness something less hopeless.
The term schizophrenia hasn't evolved with the treatment.
But many people who work in the field of schizophrenia don't think the term is the problem. Joanne Onduso runs a mental health program in Holyoke. It's headquartered in a cozy old building with couches and tables set up in a circle.
This is our group room, one of our group rooms.
The program sees people ages 16 to 30 who have started to show early signs of psychosis or delusional thinking so they can get treatment and stop it from progressing. Onduso says the staff tries to avoid using the term schizophrenia when symptoms first appear, and then only when they are sure about the diagnosis.
That is a word that's a heavy-hitting word that comes with a lot of stigma based on our collective understanding that someone with schizophrenia is someone mumbling in the street who is homeless and, you know, that kind of thing, or someone who's quote-unquote crazy.
But she points out that many aspects of mental illness carry negative connotations, like bipolar disorder or even just the word psychotic.
What needs to change is the stigma itself and not necessarily the name.
Onduso had an uncle with schizophrenia, and she remembers her family rarely discussed it at all. That, to her, is the main problem.
And I don't want to, you know, deny that language is very powerful and it, you know, can really impact us. But there are other diagnoses, too, that are diagnoses you wouldn't want to get. But let's talk, like, let's make it okay to have that disorder, you know, rather than be afraid of that word.
But there are several renaming precedents, including the change from mental retardation to intellectual disability and new categories for autism in the latest psychiatric diagnostic manual. As a medical term, schizophrenia is unlikely to officially change anytime soon. That's up to the American Psychiatric Association and its scientific advisors.
That report from Karen Brown of the New England News Collaborative. And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.